Our guest tonight, and our sole guest, is J.E. Lendon, John Lendon, who is an historian, professor of that discipline at the University of Virginia. His area is ancient history, history of the classical world, and most particularly, he has focused on the military history of the ancient world. His newest volume is stirring and significant and very, very difficult to put down. That's a cliche, but I have been deeply into this book for the last 3 or 4 days and nights. It is titled Song of Wrath, The Peloponnesian War Begins. John Lendon, you will agree with me that of all the wars, at least of antiquity, the Peloponnesian by far has had the most coverage. Why is that?
Because Thucydides is a unique genius, along with Aristotle, one of the two great singular geniuses of antiquity. And so people keep going back to it generation after generation.
It's interesting that our concept of the Peloponnesian War as having run for 31 years is really partly due to the way he constructs or reconstructs the timing and the sequencing of the war. In fact, as you make clear, it's essentially four wars, related but separate engagements, separate extended engagements.
Yeah, he, following Herodotus, wished to write about a great war. And it was a greater enterprise if it was a very long and great thing. And so he linked together four great wars, or four considerable wars, and then many smaller wars to create his great Peloponnesian War. Probably other ancient people did not divide it up in that way, or rather combined it in that way, and thought of it as a series of wars.
He's doing, in fact, what Herodotus did earlier with the Greco-Persian Wars.
Yes, although with that war, at least the Great Persian War is basically it's a 2-year thing, but it's much more coherent. The Persians arrive, they get defeated, they go home. It doesn't stop and go in the same way that the Peloponnesian War does.
A great question arises as one reads this, and as one seeks the attitudes of Thucydides, who's a fascinating guy and does creates an art form which persists down to the present. I think it provides the model far more than Herodotus does for what historians aspire to do. But the great question that his book raises and never fully answers, maybe he would have answered it if he had lived to see the end of the Peloponnesian War, is simply this. Is war inevitable? Is this the sort of thing that men fall into, differences in locality, differences in style, ultimately differences in military technique and technology, but are we eternally required or eternally fated to fall into war?
I think Thucydides would say yes. The nature of mankind does not change, he says, and that is why we should continue to be interested in his work. And it is the nature of mankind, and particularly mankind under pressure, which causes the war. And so therefore, I think he would say that wars of this nature are inevitable and are to be sought in every generation of men, probably having much the same causes and much the same consequences.
I raise the question of what the ultimate causes of war are from the point of view of Thucydides and from the point of view of one of your mentors, Donald Kagan, who is professor of history and a great historian of ancient war at Yale University, where you got your PhD. I'd like you to hear, and I'd like our listeners to hear, the first 4 or 5 minutes, or not the first, but early into our conversation with Don Kagan, this going back about 7 or 8 years ago, the question of what causes war, what propels states into war against one another. And then I want to get your commentary on it all, of course. Here, then, some 4 or 5 minutes of conversation on that very matter with Donald Kagan.
It was Einstein who wrote to Freud, saying, after World War I, saying, I don't understand war. It's such a terrible burden for mankind. You, Dr. Freud, are the great explorer of the human soul and of the recesses of the mind. Why war? And that correspondence was published under Why War?
Yes.
Well, Thucydides asked the same question much earlier, and he's got a 3-part answer.
Oh, yes. Well, that has proven to me to be one of the most illuminating things to be found in Thucydides. He has an Athenian speaker in Sparta, and I think he was reporting what the guy said, twice used this triad of motives of why people go to war, and he has them in two different sets of orders. One is fear, honor, and interest, and then the other time he has them say honor, fear, and interest. And I think you will rarely find a war of any consequence in which those things are not at play.
Fear, honor, and interest.
Yes.
What is that in ancient Greek?
Ah, let's see. Fear is deos, time, and ophelia. Ophelia can be translated as advantage also.
A Greek scholar of my acquaintance, when I asked him that, said, used tau sumpheron. What is that?
Oh, well, he doesn't use those words, but that means the advantageous.
Yeah.
But Thucydides doesn't use that term. He actually uses ophelia.
Fear is essentially is fear that somebody's gaining on you, that somebody is threatening you, that unless you meet his power and his malign intent with an equally aggressive response, you might be swamped and the whole city-state or the whole polis might be destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the wonderful thing is that there's a whole range of fear causing events, and different people can operate at different levels of sophistication. Guy comes at you with a club, you feel fear, and one of the possible reactions is to get your own club, and that's mm-hmm. there too. But Thucydides, when he's talking about fairly sophisticated states, which are Athens and Sparta are, and leaders of coalitions, empires, they do what we do. They think ahead. And they say, how will this action create an impact on what will happen in the future? Maybe today that's okay. But if we don't do something about that, down the road we'll be in trouble, and that can lead them.
That's what modern strategic theorists call worst-case analysis.
Worst-case analysis. But it's just, it can be simply analysis. Sometimes they will conclude, that's not a big deal, we don't have to worry about it. But sometimes they will say, that's a real fear, a legitimate fear, we got to do something about it.
So that's fear.
Yes.
The other part of the triad is interest, meaning...
interest is what most people in the 21st century think people go to war about, and they're wrong. To gain some material end is what they usually have. Like oil from Iraq. The people talk about going to war. Yes, it's about oil in Iraq, but it's not about our getting the oil or having it cheaper or making a lot of money selling it. It's about preventing a dangerous character from using his control of oil for strategic purposes that will have devastating political results.
So, in fact, it's fear still.
It's a form of fear, but the one that gets the least appreciation in the 20th century, and my studies convince me, is the most frequently present and the most frequently important, is honor. It's a word we don't even use, and people don't know what you mean by that. But in international relations, it means things like respect. It means things like prestige. It has to do with a sense. It's really best thought of, I think, in the negative. You don't want somebody to be able to treat you with contempt, to dishonor you.
Here's one instance of the application of that concern by a president of the United States and the people around him. Lyndon Johnson keeps us in the Vietnam War, basically because maybe the dominoes will fall, but really they will fall only because we will lose that degree of respect around the world that is accorded to us as a major power, and that will then put us in a much weaker position in the face of future challenges.
Absolutely. Every president who dealt with Vietnam had to confront this problem. If we retreat from Vietnam, we may be perceived as lacking the qualities necessary to sustain ourselves against the Soviet Union, and we may be lost in that struggle.
And with that, we fade from that program of some years ago and directly back to J.E. Lyndon. You recognize the thought of your old mentor.
Oh, yes, very much. And, of course, I admire his formulations very much, although he is, of course, expanding a little on Thucydides, because Thucydides does mention fear, honor, and advantage, but Thucydides is primarily interested in fear, and he then rather abandons in his analysis, particularly of the causes of the Peloponnesian War, the other two considerations.
And you have become persuaded, as Don Kagan is, I think, as well, that honor, the defense of honor, the avoidance of shame and of humiliation, which may be threatening you, or simply as you gain in power, as you gain in wealth, and in strength, you want a bigger reputation in the world or in the world of reference. In this case, it's the Greek states and the Mediterranean cultures. But you essentially assert that honor is what is most often at issue in war.
That's right. I guess what I would do would be to expand on Don's definition of honor. You and he were talking about it in terms of credibility. To me, that makes it a subcategory of fear. And you are, of course, in excellent company when you do that, because that's what all our realist professors of international relations mm-hmm. would do. They make reputation and prestige into a subcategory of fear. Or something that you that you want in order to drive fear away. To the Greeks, and indeed to many modern peoples, it doesn't work like that. Honor is something, credibility is part of it, but you don't seek it chiefly because you just want people to fear you. You don't seek it because you want credibility. You seek it for itself. You regard the international community as ranked from top to bottom, and that it is overwhelmingly important that you should rank higher than your neighbors, and ideally higher than everybody.
And that's what you say really motivated the Peloponnesian War. That's what motivated much of the war of the ancient Mediterranean world, though it no longer has that same sort of omnipresence in the waging of modern war. Thus, the title, Song of Wrath. The wrath makes as much reference as anything else to the very model of war and the model of the warrior, which we get in the founding document of Greek civilization, namely the Iliad.
That's correct. In the Iliad, of course, the major conflict is between the heroes, the Greek heroes Agamemnon and Achilles. And Agamemnon insults Achilles, attacks his honor, and therefore Achilles first tries to kill him, and when is prevented from doing so by Athena, he then withdraws from the Trojan War and goes and sulks in his tent, which he does for most of the Iliad, until his companion Patroclus is killed, whereupon he changes the subject of his wrath from his own side, Agamemnon, to the Trojans, and the second half of the Iliad is about his wrath at the enemy.
Sing, muse, the wrath of Achilles, Peleus' son, who brought a rain of woes upon the Achaeans. I think that's the way, in one translation, the Iliad begins.
That's right, who brought thousandfold woes upon the Achaeans and sent many brave
yes.
souls of heroes down to Hades.
We have to come to that war directly and examine the way they fell into it, the way it was waged, the ultimate consequences of that war, both in terms of immediate disorder and death and tribulation, and in terms of setting a kind of a model for military life on into the future, possibly even down to our own time. We return directly to conversation with J.E. Lendon, drawing from his supreme and superb new work, Song of Wrath. That book, by the way, is just published by Basic Books, and we're directly back to it after these words. And we return to J.E. Lendon, drawing from his very significant new book, and utterly readable, Song of Wrath. The Peloponnesian War begins. Before we begin to consider the war as it breaks out and as it is waged, what is the cost of this war? That's one way to examine the significance of a war. How many were killed? How much was lost? Well, how did it transform the world in which it occurred?
Well, in the short run, and indeed in the long run, both sides, both of the major powers, lose somewhere between a third and a half of their whole population, which is, of course, losses which no modern state has ever endured in warfare.
So it's not just the military who are killed. Civilians are killed in large numbers.
Well, the Athenians, of course, suffer a great plague, and that kills a vast number of people, but yes, civilians are also killed in considerable numbers, particularly on the Athenian side.
And of course, the war is in four separate phases. We're focused on the first phase, which is often referred to as the what is the term?
The Archidamian War, after the Spartan king Archidamus,
right.
who leads the initial Peloponnesian, that's the Spartan side, expeditions into the territory of Athens.
Now, here's what Thucydides says, I think, believe in the first chapter, about what his intention is. If I can find it, I had it here someplace. The absence of romance in my history will, I fear, detract somewhat from its interest. But if it is judged worthy by those inquirers who desire an exact knowledge of the past as an aid to the understanding of the future, which in the course of human things must resemble if it does not reflect it, I shall be content. In fine, I have written my work not as an essay with which to win the applause of the moment, but as a possession for all time. He's making a great assertion there. Learn about the real nature of this war, and this will be of great value to understand, and maybe even to organize and win, or if not to prevent, future wars. He's saying history is philosophy by examples.
Well, so indeed, generations have found the his account of the Peloponnesian War, and of course, it's still read eagerly not only in universities, but also at places like the Naval War College, where they think that great wisdom about national strategy and leadership can still be found in it. That was his intention. He has what we would call didactic aims, in large part, to tell you how to deal with various things. Some of the things are sort of peculiar to the Greeks, you know, sort of how to organize a fighting retreat with a hoplite army, how to besiege a city and things like that, which he, of course, naturally assumed that eternity would consist entirely of classical Greeks. So he thought that would be useful. People have found that useful, but it's mostly his philosophy, his understanding of how men react in war, his understanding of national strategy, of the relation between leaders and followers. Those are the things now that we look to particularly.
And then the subtitle of your book, Song of Wrath, subtitle The Peloponnesian War Begins. How indeed does it begin?
Well, it begins with the Spartans, the Peloponnesian side, marching into Attica, the territory of Athens. They do so very slowly with a certain amount of delay because they want the Athenians to surrender or yield in any matter, because that will prove that they are superior. This is a war, again, over rank and honor, and it's enormously important to get the other side to back down.
But what precipitates it? Why do the Spartans march in at all?
They feel that the Athenian presumption has become intolerable. The Spartans are traditionally the hegemon of Greece, that is to say, the nation with the highest rank, the highest honor. They have been that since the middle part of the previous century, and they believe that they have a right to that unequaled position and therefore to respect from everybody else. And in the years before the war, the Athenians are not showing them the respect they want. The Spartans set a series of tests for the Athenians, saying, if you'll do this, there won't be war. If you show respect to us, if you bend the knee to us, there won't be war and you can have peace. And the Athenians under Pericles, who wish to assert their equality in honor with the Spartans, say, no, we are going to go about our business and we are not going to bend the knee. We are not going to defer to you. And therefore, the Spartans finally conclude that this is intolerable and that they must go to war to vindicate their supreme rank.
And thus, we have a confirmation of the general thesis that guides your book, that more than any of the other two sources of war, more than interest or fear, the need for honor, for prestige, for maintaining your rank or gaining a higher rank, that comes first, not only in individual lives, but in the interaction between states.
That is correct. The Greeks do not see much of a difference between the motivations of individuals and raison d'etat. That is to say, they consider states to act essentially with the same motivations and reactions that individuals have. That is why the book is called Song of Wrath, because the Spartans can have anger. They can be described as becoming angry. We find that very odd. We think that states act in a more sort of abstract and elevated fashion. But to the Greeks, a state is just a large person with lots of little people inside it, and it reacts just as a person does, and moreover, reacts not as a contemporary Greek would, but in many cases as a Homeric hero would. So states are in fact more touchy about their honor than individuals would be.
One wonders how this applies, or if it does apply, to a modern war. Thinking of great wars, thinking of World War II, and thinking of the Nazis, who certainly precipitated that war, one wonders if they were after an increase in their honor, or was something else involved. Surely there was a mythology that they were drawing upon, just as the Athenians drew upon the Iliad. Let's persist. Allow me to persist as I press that question upon you, right after we pause to find out who's been doing what and who's been doing what wrong in the current world today. We go to the newsroom for an update from David Jennings. And we return to conversation with J.E. Lyndon, author of Song of Wrath, The Peloponnesian War Begins. Is it too fanciful, or is it stretching too far to find some parallel between Sparta and its initiation of the Peloponnesian War and Nazi Germany and its initiation of World War II?
I do not think it is fanciful at all. It seems to me that the Nazis were, among other things, very largely interested in a sort of conception of their national grandeur, and particularly, and this is very clear from the things they say, in revenge for the tremendous decline in their national position, their national honor, which they had been inflicted on them at the end of the First World War. It is the rhetoric of revenge that you usually look for when you are trying to find cases of national honor, national rank in causing wars. And I think that's a very good one there. Similarly, of course, this sort of analysis is very useful for things like the origins of the First World War too, where the inability of the various sides to back down was not only a question of credibility, but also a question simply of their sense of their own standing and their not wishing to be humiliated.
You know, if one pursues your view that essentially the core, the cause, the source, the founding basis of war and movement into war is the pursuit of honor and the avoidance of shame, and the piling up of more and more honor or prestige, one somehow is minded to go back to the book of Ecclesiastes, one of whose great illuminations is simply the declaration, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. We're talking here about the vanity of communities, the vanity of states.
That is true, although in practice, what happens is that states rarely get into war directly to increase their honor. They tend to get into war more to defend their honor from further loss. So it is to a certain degree of vanity, but as a historian can't really accept its wholly vain quality because it is of enormous historical importance. It causes people to live and die. They regard it more important than life itself. It may be a vanity, but it is a vanity of great historical moment.
Let's come directly to the war and the waging thereof, if only in a quick overview. We've talked about its beginning with an incursion by the Spartans onto the territory of Attica. And then what happened?
Well, the Athenians refused to come out to fight them. This was the strategy of Pericles. Athens is a fortified city connected to its port by walls, and the Athenians do not need to come out to fight. They cannot be laid under siege, and so they just remain behind their walls. And the Spartans, therefore, must do the old traditional thing that you do in Greek warfare to humiliate an enemy that won't come out from behind his walls, which is ravage the countryside, which is basically sort of wreck everything, burn the crops, ruin the houses, steal whatever has not been removed. And this is a traditional way of raising your honor and reducing the honor of the person that you do this to. The Athenians cannot face the Spartans in the field because they are hugely outnumbered, but also the Spartans are the greatest warriors in the world. And so the Athenians have to take revenge to get their honor back, and they do this by sea. They send a fleet out around the Peloponnese, which is the area where Sparta is, and they sail around wrecking stuff in exactly the same way that Sparta has been wrecking stuff in the territory of Athens. And so the two acts balance out. The Spartans would say that they have achieved more because, of course, it's much braver to do this on foot than it is to do it by sea. The Athenians say they have exactly balanced it out and therefore proved that they are, in fact, equal in honor to the Spartans.
Are the Athenians in that first phase, as they land at port villages controlled by Sparta, do they not only do violence to the terrain and to the buildings and so on, do they also begin killing civilians? Later, they certainly do that.
Oh, yes,
in large
very,
number.
Much. Very much. Very much. If you cannot run away from them fast enough, they will kill you or take you into slavery.
They kill the men and take the women and children into slavery.
That is the normal procedure in Greek warfare, unless it's well enough organized for there to be ransoming of the captives.
So it turns vicious, vile, and inhumane from the very beginning.
Yes. Thucydides is, of course, interested in the way in which people behave worse and worse in the course of the war. But from our standpoint, the Greek laws of war were very, as it were, forgiving to the people who were winning. And they expected that prisoners would be killed and that women and children would be taken into slavery, just as you say.
We can't do the war battle by battle and sea engagement by sea engagement. And you get all of that, to be sure, in Thucydides. But let's do that in a little bit of detail. What's the general flow and course of that war over the 10 years?
Well, the two sides keep doing, just as I said, the Spartans invading by land and the Athenians raiding by sea. And the great events, therefore, sort of tend to happen outside that structure. In the second year of the war, a plague falls upon Athens, predictably, of course, because all the Athenians are hiding within their walls in a world without good sanitation and good disease control. So a plague falls upon them, and they try to get terms from the Spartans, but no satisfactory terms can be reached. Then the Athenians start doing better and better and better. If you basically sort of regard this as two trend lines of honor, the Athenians goes up and the Spartans go down.
How do you account for their doing better?
They do better in the stuff that is not basically just the tit for tat of the raiding. They, of course, having a fleet, are much more mobile than the Spartans and can therefore go and attack Spartan allies, which humiliates the Spartans in a way that the Spartans cannot counter.
We should have made clear, I should have pressed this asked you to clarify it, that this is not merely a war between Athens and Sparta, two city-states, but between the two leagues that each of them commands and has organized.
Correct. The Spartans are the group that the Spartans control is called the Peloponnesian League, although that is a modern term for it. The group that the Athenians control is called the Delian League. The Spartan allies are mostly on land. The Athenian allies are mostly the Aegean states and the ones on the coast of Asia Minor, that is to say on what is now the west coast of Turkey.
My favorite Greek island, where I spent a month trying to write something a long, long time ago, is Aegina. That, I would assume, was part of the Delian League, was it?
Well, not really. Aegina is had been on and off against Spartan ally until the middle of the century. The Athenians then conquer it, but Aegina, extremely beautiful isle, exactly as you say, is one of the states that actually goes to Sparta and says to the Spartans, go fight the Athenians because we want you to liberate us.
Yeah, of course, they are just offshore from Piraeus.
Right. But also just offshore from the Peloponnese.
On the other side, yes.
And in the first year of the war, one of the first great sort of acts of horror in the war is that the Athenians just swoop in there and throw them all out. They say, since you caused this war or were involved in causing this war, we're just going to send you all into exile. And then they settle, they just drive them all out, and they settle the place themselves, and the Spartans have to take the Aeginetans in and give them some land of their own.
It takes 10 years to play this thing through, and would you say it's tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands who've been slaughtered thereby?
It's difficult to be absolutely certain. Probably, if you add up on both sides, you're in the territory of low hundreds of thousands. This is, you know, a fairly, by modern standards, unpopulous area. Ancient populations are low. But if you take all of the casualties and all the people killed in the plague and one thing or another, you're probably talking about the low hundred thousands.
We do also have a rhetoric, or we do also have a self-representation, certainly on the part of the Athenians. We have it in Pericles' early orations, his famous oration about the dead, about the war dead. And we have it, for that matter, from Thucydides himself, in which they are arguing that they are defending a way of life. They are defending a mode of social organization known as, quote, democracy.
Yes, although, of course, one of the striking things about Thucydides is that he has Pericles stand up and give this immortal ode to the glory of democracy, his funeral oration. And then he immediately goes into the arrival of the plague at Athens and the unbelievably bad behavior that the plague produces among the Athenians. Pericles says to the Athenians that we are basically excellent and moral and brave, and then Thucydides demonstrates that under any sort of pressure at all, they are completely horrible people.
Then Thucydides, in fact, one suspects, and this confirms it, I think, do you agree, is essentially the first of the great realists in the writing of history, and a realist not merely in the sense that he aspires to tell it the way it really happens, but also that he's got a cynicism about human motives and a cynicism about claims of moral superiority.
That is absolutely true. He is, in ethics, he is what we would call a materialist.
Yeah.
He does not, but he believes that you cannot be good if you are hungry, that man's morals decline to the level of their circumstances. And in time of war, when there's not enough to eat and when you're in constant peril, people therefore become wicked. And this is one of the things he traces, the process of people becoming wicked.
Is he in some ways the intellectual father of Machiavelli?
Very much so. Although the question in Thucydides is whether he is essentially an amoral author telling you how to behave or giving you advice of how to succeed, or whether underlying this there is a deeper morality, whether he deplores all of this. I think pretty well everyone these days thinks that there is that morality under there, that he deplores this bad behavior even as he describes it.
Just as Machiavelli claims that in The Prince, I wasn't merely advocating all of this, I was describing it the way it really is. But we need to do better than that.
Yes, and indeed. And of course, if you go to the discourses...
The discourses of Titus Livy, yes.
Yes. You quickly realize that Machiavelli is not Machiavelli, as it were.
Yeah.
He's not Machiavellian. There is a profound ethical quality to it as well. So they're both engaged in the same sort of thing, basically warning you against it, but also telling you in a world where this sort of thing happens, here's how you should protect yourself. But he doesn't think, neither of them think that it's a good thing that it happens that way. They would prefer to live in good moral universes. They're just pessimistic about the possibility of that.
Some who've written about the Peloponnesian War and about war in the ancient Greek and, for that matter, Roman world, put a great stress on the search for individual glory as well as search for glory for the state or honor for the state and the readiness to die, almost the eagerness to give one's life, but to do it bravely and heroically. The Song of Wrath is, again, a particularly appropriate title, because in their wrath, the Greek heroes way back at Troy or in this war are essentially seeking ultimate honorable death. We need to talk about the way in which they waged war, that is, the tactics of war, and how modern warfare doesn't quite follow the same rules and might lead us to a little confusion as to what the Greeks were really like as warriors. We'll return, if you're willing, to that particular question when we return after these words. And directly back to J.E. London, drawing from his new book, Song of Wrath, How the Peloponnesian War Began. You know, John, a frequent guest, fairly frequent on this program, has been Victor Davis Hanson on various political issues and aspects of troubled modernity. But, as you know, he's also a classic historian, and he did a book a few years ago titled A War Like No Other, How the Athenians and Spartans Fought the Peloponnesian War. And I do think that he tends to favor the view or follow the view that they threw themselves into it almost with a will to die so long as they could do it heroically. Is that his representation, and do you agree?
I think that is true. He, of course, achieved fame first as a classicist in my profession.
Victor did, yes.
Victor, with a wonderful book called The Western Way of War,
mm-hmm.
which was the book which basically really broke down how Greek infantry, how Greek hoplites fight, and the business of them crashing into each other and that sort of thing. And that book is still much the best thing on the subject, and incredibly evocative and fun to read. A tremendous thing. But yes, I mean, the thing is that the Greeks are not, shall we say, default pacifists like we are. They don't, you know, go into war, and then when asked what they're doing, they don't say we're here to do a job like our soldiers do. They don't really conceal the fact that they rather enjoy it, that they consider it the ultimate test of their manhood, and that this is something they feel they ultimately ought to be doing.
That would be true of the Spartans. Would that have been true as well of the Athenians?
Yes, although to a certain degree, to a lesser extent,
yeah.
Spartan society is incredibly
warrior society,
focused
totally.
On the making of war, the humiliating of cowards and things like that. Athenian society, you know, certain society is like a shark. That's one, it does one thing, gobbles things up. Athenian society is more like a dolphin. It sort of leaps around. It's also a voracious predator, but it also is playful,
yeah.
And multifaceted.
That's a wonderful metaphor. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
But still, the Athenians are looking for heroic death as well, you say?
Yes. Again, you can just look into the funeral oration, which is largely about heroic death. And, of course, we have other funeral orations surviving from antiquity. They wrap the hero, they wrap the dead person, the war dead, in the glory of the city. And they basically say, you know, you make us glorious, we make you glorious. This is the most important thing that a man can possibly do. That would seem to be basically how the Greeks thought of this sort of thing.
So if they're after heroic death, how does that affect, or how is that visible in the actual military tactics that they employ?
Well, they like fighting nose to nose with contact weapons. They're not much for throwing things and not much for shooting arrows and things like that. They are simultaneously, what makes their method of warfare curious is that they're simultaneously fighting for individual honor and for the honor of their city, and that they want to do so in basically analogous ways. And so in practice, what they do is they gather in big blocks of people called the phalanx, very heavily armored guys with great big shields and spears, and they run at each other, charge each other, and crash into each other. And a total mess results from that. Sometimes they sort of pull back a bit and poke each other with spears. Sometimes they just push against the enemy and push them back by bodily force. One side eventually runs away, and you prove that you have been heroic by your performance in the combat and your refusal to run away. And your side proves that it has been heroic similarly by pushing the other side away.
So these are battles done in an afternoon, one would assume.
Yes, usually exactly that. They tend to, so far as we can tell, last 2 to 3 hours.
And at what cost in death and maiming?
There is a famous article on this subject by a colleague of mine. The winners tend to lose about 5% of their men. The losers tend to lose something between 10 and 15% of their men. So by modern standards, the losses are very considerable in very small populations.
But everyone's enjoying themselves.
Well,
in a way.
I guess one should not say, sort of trivialized to enjoy themselves. They regard it as...
They're a noble pursuit.
Yeah, it's a noble pursuit. It's something we would call, you know, equivalent to... It's very similar to our sorts of sports, which is at a high level, you may or may not enjoy it, but you do think you're doing something that is noble and important.
But would it not be the case that if this is the way of war in ancient Greece, that this is essentially ruinous to the maintenance of any state. It's ruinous to social stability, if only by virtue of the depletion of materiel and of lives, which will occur rather soon.
And this is indeed what happens. The Spartans are continuously losing population from the Persian War, when we know they have something like 8,000 warriors, down to 370s, when it looks like their total population is down to something like 1,500 of citizen warriors. The Athenians lose, again, something like a third to half their population in the Peloponnesian War, their warriors, and they never gain it back. They remain a much less populous state subsequently. And, of course, the result is that powerful other peoples come and swoop in on them. The Macedonians eventually take advantage of the weakness of Greece. But it is the honor of the individual and the honor of the city is more important than its economic success.
Also amazing in all of this, though, of course, is the extent to which they built, the Athenians particularly, built so high a culture in terms of... scientific and humanistic achievement.
It comes down to the same thing, because when they're not competing in warfare, they are competing, for example, in writing tragedies.
Yeah.
What we think of as Greek high culture, things like writing tragedies, are intensely and overwhelmingly competitive. Their prizes are given, mm-hmm, yeah. Votes are taken, and things like that. And it's exactly the same drive that produces both of the effects, and it is the most important drive in Greek culture.
It's visible also in the Olympic Games.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
We are a bit overdue for a stop for an update on the news, and then we return to J.E. London. And as we return to conversation with J.E. London, a moment out to... point out that we've got lots of interesting history on our regular website for this program. Podcasts of all sorts of topics with all sorts of guests, but I'm just now scanning the top page. We have literally hundreds of podcasts, but we have some 20 or so displayed on the front page of our website. And I note, of course, the program listed as an extension 720 Classic with Donald Kagan, of which we played a small portion earlier tonight. I note as well a program also of some years ago, another classic, with Ian Kershaw, great English historian who did a major two-volume history of essentially a political history of Hitler and more broadly thus of the whole Nazi period. And most recently we did a program on December 7th, commemorating the American involvement in the European side of World War II, that with Colonel John Votaw, another military historian, and much else of that sort, including, I note, as I'm scanning the page, another classic which we put up a while ago, namely a conversation with Henry Kissinger about the relations between states and the role of war inevitably does arise in that context. There's much else of a quite different order on our website and beyond that on all the other pages which are available just on a click. You get to all of that by going to wgnradio.com/extension720. wgnradio.com/extension720. And you'll find there even the program that we did last Sunday night on poetry with two leading teachers of poetry who are also working poets and who read a lot of great stuff, some of which I had never heard before but was quite impressed by. For that and anything else you want, you'll find it at Extension 720. And that's a good way to get your Extension 720 fix if you want it in the middle of the day or if you want to download some material for playing later on. With that, quickly back to J.E. Lendon. Let's just look for a moment at the heroics, or at least some of the more brilliant moments in the war, including some of the great figures. Who were the military geniuses of the war?
Well, the great military genius of the war is a Spartan by the name of Brasidas.
Yes.
Who leads he has various adventures, but particularly he leads an army, a very messy sort of ad hoc army into the north of Greece and attacks Athenian possessions up there with great success, and essentially captures a very important city, which the Athenians call Amphipolis, which the Athenians are desperate to get back. And that's one of the reasons that peace is finally made. He is, without question, the most remarkable commander, except when he finally, he's pretty well undefeated, except when he finally gets himself killed. But even then, he gets killed in the course of a great victory, the victory that ultimately allows the war to be ended on terms satisfactory to the Spartans. The Athenians at some level win it, but they would not have gotten terms anywhere near as good if Brasidas had not won at the Battle of Amphipolis in 422 BC.
How did old Thucydides do as a commander? Because he was in that war.
Yeah, he was a disgrace. And indeed, the reason he had the opportunity to write was that he was sent into exile. It's good that I mentioned Amphipolis, because his job was to protect Amphipolis. We don't know exactly why he wasn't on his station in the area, but he was some distance away when Brasidas snuck up by night and basically grabbed the city. And as a result, he was put on trial when he returned to Athens, and he was sent into exile. And so he spends the rest of the war in exile and does his writing there, and that gives him the opportunity to consult people on both sides, because he is presumably in some ancestral castle his family owns in Thrace, and he can talk to people from both sides, and does so, and that is why he can accumulate such good data about the war.
They were pretty hard, the Athenians were, on losing commanders. One remembers that Pericles dies of a natural death only a few years after the war begins, but Pericles' son, also a Pericles, is a losing commander, and he's, I guess, tried and executed.
Yes, in fact, not a losing commander, a victorious commander.
And still executed. For what?
Yes, this is the notorious trial of the Arginusae generals after the great victory. This is in the later years of the war, the great naval victory the Athenians win. There is a problem. When Greeks fight at sea, they fight in very light ships, which when rammed, these are ramming galleys, don't sink. They just sort of swamp. And therefore, they leave many hundreds of people just clinging to them. And after the battle, the victorious side goes and picks up all of its people clinging to the wrecks, and either kills or picks up and takes into captivity the people on the other side. It's enormously important to do that. It's also enormously important to pick up the dead, because the Greeks believe that unless you get proper rites of burial and get a coin put under your tongue, you never get to Hades, but instead wander around forever as a ghost, which is very scary to everybody. After that great battle, after that great victory, a storm comes up and the generals fail to recover the men clinging to the wrecks and the dead bodies. And when they get back to Athens, they are put on their trial and executed. This is in the sort of anti-democratic literature that survives to us from antiquity. The two greatest crimes of the democracy are killing the Arginusae generals and, of course, killing Socrates.
Of course, what do we know about Socrates in relation to the war? How do his dates work in terms of the war itself?
Well, he fights in the war.
Yeah.
We know that. He is not a particularly young man, but you continue to fight in Greek armies until you were quite old. And he fights at the beginning and he fights in the middle. And he presumably, if we knew more, would have fought a lot more. Or we would know that he did fight a lot more if we knew. And his main contribution in that sense is the negative one of hanging out with a lot of aristocratic young men who are extremely dubious about the wisdom of the Athenian democracy, as, of course, Thucydides is himself. And these young men, after the war, are placed in charge of Athens by the Spartans as a narrow oligarchy, basically a committee of 30 called the 30 mm-hmm. Tyrants to run the thing in the Spartan interest. They kill a whole mess of people and they are terrible. And everyone blames Socrates for this because so many of these guys were the sort of young men who followed. He doesn't exactly have students, right, because he's not formally a teacher, but the sort of young men who follow Socrates around the town to watch him ask his questions and humiliate people. And this is the background to his trial and execution, the fact that was thought to be implicated in teaching these young men who then behave so extraordinarily badly.
Life in Athens was by no means soporific. Seems to have been a scandal and violence almost every day.
Fair enough. The Athenians would say, to the contrary, that the whole point of living in the city is that you don't have to go armed. But their politics are incredibly rambunctious. There is no question about that.
It's their politics, as we say in Chicago, politics ain't a beanbag. I think that was that's a quote from a famous old Chicago politician. It's dirty pool.
Yes.
And that seems to be the case in Athens as well.
The thing about Athens is that it is a direct democracy. The people yeah. in their assembly make decisions directly. Holding office is not really important. What is important is the ability to convince the people to do things your way time after time. And even the business of being heard by the people is extremely sort of irregular and rambunctious. Essentially, anyone can attempt to be heard, and if the people don't want to hear you, they just shout you down. And if they want to hear you, they let you talk.
A remaining question, which I pose to you just as we pause for a quick round of commercials, and then I hope we can discuss this a bit, is was Thucydides right when he said that he's giving us a possession for the ages? Are there lessons that he draws or that can be drawn which really illuminate the present time and eternal time with regard to the operations and the challenges between states and the waging of war and possibly even finding a solution to the drift towards or the attraction towards war? What are the lessons that are applicable from this from that time to this very moment? We return to J.E. Lendon, continuing to draw from his book, Song of Wrath, The Peloponnesian War Begins, but first these words. And back to our guest of the evening on Extension 720, J.E. Lendon, who is professor of history, the specialty being, of course, ancient history, at the University of Virginia. The book in hand, and it's his third major work, is titled Song of Wrath, The Peloponnesian War Begins, Basic Books, The Publishers. Are there then, as Thucydides promised, there would be lessons to be drawn for eternity?
I think Thucydides would certainly think so, and I've just been thinking about what he might regard as his most important lesson. I think probably, ultimately, he would want us to take away the idea that democracies make very bad imperialists. That they are not good at running empires. And also on top of that, that war makes people bad, that human ethics are a consequence in large part of circumstance, not of character.
Yet he would argue that war we shall always have with us, just as Jesus tells us the poor we shall always have with us. Would he not argue that?
Yes. He cannot imagine, and no Greek indeed can imagine, a world without war. In fact, a world without war much more frequent than we are used to.
Yeah. Can you imagine a world without war?
I can imagine a world without war because I also study a society which created such a world, which is that of the Roman Empire. But I can also imagine not wanting to live there. To produce a world without war, you have to create an extraordinary degree of boring staticness.
How do you make the Roman Empire a world without war? They wage a lot of wars on the periphery all the time.
On the periphery. I'm talking about the sort
but
of
not
central
in, not
area
in Rome, yeah.
where they do manage to produce a profound and extended peace. Of course, no. They're fighting the barbarians. They are fighting the Jews, various other rebellious groups. Of course, they're fighting all the time. But there is some truth to calling it the Roman peace because
yes.
vast areas of territory, that nothing much happens. And when I say nothing much happens, I mean nothing much happens. The same human drives that produce everything we admire and are interested in society are the drives that produce war. And therefore, if you do not have war, if you tamp down things and create peace, you have a society like that of the Roman Empire where nothing much changes for 200 years, where people are even writing essentially the same poem 200 years later than they were 200 years before.
As you look at the wars that are raging right now, or that have come and gone in fairly recent modern time, do they all sort of fit the basic analysis of wars of in which honor is the key issue? For example, look at the continuing war, if one may call it that, and I think properly we can, against the Western world, issuing from Muslim terrorism.
I would not say for a moment that all wars fall into this type of analysis. Thucydides is quite right that fear and interest do play their role, although, as Don Kagan said in that little passage you read us you let us listen to in the last hour, interest in the sense of financial concerns are, in fact, much less important than many people think. I have to confess that I really did get the idea for this book in large part wondering, like everyone else in the world, why 9/11 happened and why these people are so mad and want to do this stuff.
And the mystery of suicide assaults, you mean?
Yes, exactly. And it's very easy then to go on the web and discover many of the remarks made over the years by Osama bin Laden. And he has a great deal to say about revenge. And it struck me that he was saying things that would have been familiar to any Greek. And therefore, I sort of looked back and I thought, you know, can I study what's happening in our world by studying the Greeks? And it seemed the answer was very much, yes, I could.
Osama bin Laden is taking revenge not merely on years of colonial domination in the Middle East, but he's taking revenge upon the Crusaders.
Yes. People should, in fact, read what he has, transcripts of his tapes, because they're in many ways extremely alarmingly interesting. He has a very sort of long series of things that he is taking revenge for. There's a sort of sense that every additional slight adds to revives slights of old, that if we were not behaving badly now, he wouldn't be so worried about the Crusades, but it sort of adds to the pile, and it keeps getting refired, as it were, sort of like a set of old embers.
How does the Cold War between the United States and its league, so to speak, and the Soviet Union and its league, and which raged for some 40 years, one might say, how does that fit this analysis? It did not break out into full war, though there were skirmishes now and again.
In the Cold War, you have there are obviously prestige considerations, and you can point to things like, for example, the moon program and things like that. There, to a certain degree, prestige did serve as a proxy for fear. It was a matter of producing credibility.
But how do you fit ideology in? Since we were both proclaiming that each side proclaims it had the best system and the other one was ruinous.
Well, indeed. And the way in which those two sides were competing were by and large through prestige considerations, building stuff, going to the moon and things like that. Part of your national pride can be ideological. This is why ideological states and religious states tend to be particularly touchy and concerned about revenge. I mean, an example now is Iran, which considers itself to be sort of on the cutting edge religiously and is enormously difficult to deal with and touchy. Partially for that reason. And then, of course, North Korea, which is weird in so many ways, but one of its ways is it's one of the few really capital I ideological states left in the world. And their bad behavior there is very much revenge oriented. They have a very high conception of the national rank they think they should possess, and ideology is a very large part of that.
Another war that has been raging for some time at a low level, but full of vehemence all the same, and it breaks out occasionally, is between two fascinating states who used to be part of one state. I have in mind India and Pakistan.
Yes, and of course, there is an enormous degree of prestige consideration there. It is generally the case that we are much more in the West are much more oblivious to these considerations than many Middle Eastern and Eastern countries. The Chinese are particularly interested in this sort of thing, and you can read their communiques. They're very concerned about their national rank.
I read an interesting paper of yours just today. I got it off Google. I think you published it probably only within the last few days about China urging all other nations stay away from the Nobel Prize ceremonies, or else there are going to be negative consequences.
Yes, and this, it seems to me, is a superb example of a state which is acting, to our mind, completely irrationally. But to their mind, since they are extremely anxious about their national rank, they feel a huge insult has been done to them by giving this Nobel Prize.
Let me make clear to whom they've given it.
They have given it to this eminent Chinese dissident, who is, of course, a prisoner of the Chinese regime. And by giving him the Nobel Prize, they think they have been insulted and are doing everything they possibly can, both to palliate the insult and to insult everyone in return, because that is how this works. This works by reciprocity. If someone takes your honor away by insulting you, you must insult him back to get it back. If someone hits you, you must hit him back.
I note that you spent part of your formative years in Japan. Is that right?
Yes, very much.
They have the concept of om, is that the word? At any rate, the concept of honor and the maintenance of face and so on. It figures very strongly in that society, apparently.
Yes, very much, although one of the things that contemplating Japan teaches you is the countervailing forces. The Japanese are, of course, the great masters of self-control. And this is also true in Greece, where the supreme virtue, sophrosune, is self-control. This is what differentiates individuals from states. Individuals have self-control. When you hit them, they don't hit back necessarily.
J.E., I'm running quite late, and we've got to pause right now for an update on the news. But before we do that, it is time to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines right now. Any question you want to raise to J.E. Lenden, do by all means give us a quick ring. 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. For any question or, for that matter, any comment you might want to offer. Similarly, if you're listening to us over the Internet at some greater distance, you can reach us, of course, via email, the email address extension720@wgnradio.com. extension720@wgnradio.com or the aforesaid 312-591-7200. Get your calls and emails in quickly. We'll be with you. And directly back to J.E. Lenden, who is our special guest tonight on Extension 720. His new book And though it's a cliched word, it is, I would say, truly a masterly book. You are in total command of this material, and you've extracted from it meanings that I think have eluded some other scholars. Song of Wrath, The Peloponnesian War Begins, is just published by Basic Books. And we go directly to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Mo is first up. Good evening.
Good evening. I've really learned a lot that I hadn't known, despite the fact that I have a college education, including things about Socrates that I didn't know. It strikes me that the role of Aegina as a client state, which got Sparta into the war, maybe they would have gotten into a war anyhow, but that was the occasion. It reminds me of the role of Serbia as a client state of Tsarist Russia, getting Russia into World War One, and now we have three client states in the, or maybe four client states in the Middle East that have certainly got us involved in a war that may be beyond our capacity. You have to watch out for these little states that get pretty rambunctious.
Well, I don't know what client states you have in mind. If you mean Iraq or Afghanistan, they are not merely clients. They are, in some sense, constructions by us. But let me go to J.E. on that. What do you think?
Yeah, the thing about client states is that you do have to keep a good hold of them. Once you have taken them into your responsibility, you do have to ensure that they do behave, or you're going to have all sorts of problems with them because they're going to conduct their own affairs and give you lots of trouble. The better parallel here is not necessarily the Greeks, but the Romans. The Roman Empire, under Augustus, is surrounded by a ring of client kings, client kingdoms, and basically over the next 50 years, all of those are transformed into provinces, because even with the governing genius of the Romans, they really can't get them to behave properly. And one after another, the kings are either thrown out, or when they die, they're just replaced with Roman governors. And so eventually Rome becomes the place we know, which is basically a big empire with borders rather than a collection of client states on the side. It doesn't seem to be a system which, even, as I say, even the Romans were very good at this sort of thing, can make work for a very long time.
Back to the phones. Next up at WGN Radio is Tom. Good evening, sir.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. This is great. I've got maybe a strange question. I don't know. But if you were talking about the difference in, I guess, ferocity of the Spartans versus the Athenians, if you could look at Sparta and Athens as two ends of a spectrum, where would you place Clausewitz and General George Patton in there? And I'll take my answer off the phone.
No, you better stay with us for a moment. That's an interesting formulation. Clausewitz, of course, essentially is a theorist rather than an active fighter. What do you think, J.E.?
Well, Patton, I think one would put him very much at the sort of Spartan end. This is a guy who sort of lived for warfare. Poor old Clausewitz spent an enormous amount of his life in unsuccessful politics and generally in exile. So he seems to be a rather more Athenian figure.
That's what I wanted to hear. And thank you. Did you have a question of me, Milt?
No, I just wanted you to stay with it for further clarification. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email from a listener in the New York area. Two questions. Do we know whether Machiavelli read Thucydides? I'm thinking in particular of the Melian Dialogue, as it is called. Second, last time I taught Thucydides in my Western Civ class, some of the students wanted to know how much we know about the other Peloponnesian Wars from contemporary sources other than his work. Interesting questions.
Interesting questions. I am no authority on Machiavelli. My sense is that Machiavelli is a bit early for many Greek texts to be circulated.
Of course, we know that Hobbes read Thucydides, must have been strongly influenced by him, even translated him.
Yes, indeed. I'm just too ignorant to answer that. We don't have a lot of good other stuff. Most of the other evidence we have is from people, later ancient authors who read Thucydides, mm-hmm. and added a certain amount to it. We have some Lives of Plutarch of varying values. We have a later, not very bright historian by the name of Diodorus of Sicily. Again, mostly just misunderstood Thucydides. The major independent attestations we have are Athenian inscriptions, that is to say, carved stones upon which the Athenians wrote down a great number of laws and lists of things they were buying and things of that nature. Many of these survive, and we can use those to a certain degree. The problem with that type of evidence is it's very difficult to date, because the Athenians did not date those documents systematically, and they tend to survive to us in incredibly beaten up and miserable form anyway.
Are there then in antiquity some lost wars who had no historian, which had no historian, so that we know very little about them?
Oh, well, indeed. There were such wars, but there were also, of course, the fact that we don't have most ancient texts.
Yes.
For example, one of the great ancient wars, the great ancient battles, the Battle of Ipsus, which basically ends up organizing the Hellenistic world after the death of Alexander. We have no really good account of that at all, because all of those accounts have perished. I mean, there will have been historians at the time, but it just doesn't survive to us.
And they didn't all get lost in the burning of the great library at Alexandria, which is a myth, I think, that's widely credited.
Well, no. I mean, basically, we lose Greek texts because of the great moment of problem there is the Turkish capture of Constantinople.
Uh-huh.
That is when you get the sort of astonishing moment that, you know, we realize that we have all these plays of Euripides, but most of them start with the same letter. Because that means that somebody at one stage, when they were burning Constantinople, grabbed one volume, the E through I volume, and ran away with it. And we don't have the others because those volumes were not preserved.
Incredible. We are about to pause for the usual reasons, the last round of commercials. But I might say that we now have one or two lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, move quickly and somebody will get through. At 312-591-7200. And we return in just an instant to J.E. Lendon and to your calls for him. Just a quick word about tomorrow night. We'll be on for just the 1 hour tomorrow night after the hockey game, coming on at 11. My guest will be Ward Miller, one of the co-authors of a beautiful and very significant book that's just been published, which gives you a full photographic record of the great architectural works of Adler and Sullivan, most of it in Chicago, or much of it in Chicago. So this will be a sort of an illustrated guide to the history of modern architecture as it began in Chicago. That's tomorrow at 11 p.m. Thursday night, the full two-hour program again, as we're joined by the great scholar of modern, and for that matter of ancient religion, Martin Marty, who's done yet another interesting book, always a person well worth talking with. He being emeritus professor of the history of Christianity at the University of Chicago. 312-591-7200 as we go to Clark. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. In the last 100 years or so, we've seen a number of proxy wars, Vietnam in the 60s or Afghanistan in the 80s. Did the Greeks participate in that, or was it seen as dishonorable to have others do your fighting?
It depended on the others. You could certainly use proxies if they were, as it were, noble proxies. One of the things that the Greeks are reluctant to do, for example, is to raise the slaves of an opponent of an opposing side to fight against them, because they are regarded as a dishonorable combatants, and you cannot elevate the honor or the rank of your nation by using them. But certainly, for example, All during the period of my book, there is a sort of proxy war going on in Sicily, which the Athenians intermittently get involved with, between two coalitions in Sicily, which are lined up with the coalitions back in Greece. And those wars do have an impact on the honor of the people back in Greece, depending on who happens to be winning at the time. So it's very much something they do.
Of course, the Sicilian campaign is one of the great disasters as well, is it not?
Well, that's the later Sicilian campaign.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, during the Archidamian War, there's a lot of desultory fighting in Sicily. That is not satisfactory to the Athenians, and therefore after the Archidamian War, they send their great expedition to try to conquer Syracuse, and they all get killed.
In fact, they come into a sort of a ravine in their boats, and the enemy is up on top, and they throw hell at them and destroy them, don't they?
Yeah, they suffer miseries of every possible sort. Thucydides says that destruction of every type fell upon them.
And who was the commander? Was it Themistocles, or
no? This is the Athenian commander. There is a benevolent and not very competent sort by the name of Nicias.
Oh yes, Nicias,
who Thucydides admires as a man, but obviously thinks was a deeply incompetent general.
Well, since we've come to that, and while we're at it, let's, if only briefly, look at the rest of the war. After all, it runs until what year exactly?
It runs until 404 BC.
404, having started supposedly in 431. And you've just taken us in this book quite properly to 421. What can be said about the rest of it?
Well, what happens essentially is that there's then a period of peace. The Athenians become interested in fighting in Sicily. They go and fight in Sicily while they're still at peace with Sparta. In the course of their fighting in Sicily, war breaks out back in Greece, which wouldn't be a serious thing. But then there's a disaster. Then there's the disaster in Sicily, and a great number of their allied or subject states rebel. And that means that the new war, which is called the Ionian Decalean War, is an altogether more sinister business for the Athenians, because they are trying to keep their empire down at the same time as they're trying to fight the Spartans. The Spartans are now allied with the Persians. They have a great fleet. And so there are huge sea battles in the Aegean Sea. Eventually, the Spartans win a decisive battle and besiege Athens, and Athens is forced to surrender.
And that's the end.
And that's the end.
And shortly thereafter, the Macedonians descend like wolves upon the fold.
Well, not for it takes them a long time, but basically
when is that?
50 years.
About 50
years.
Years later. Yeah.
But they descend upon a much weakened Greece.
And somewhat assisted, at least Alexander is, by, of all people, Aristotle, if I remember correctly.
Yes, he is, of course. Aristotle is Alexander's tutor.
Yeah.
It's one of those sort of astonishing facts that if it weren't true, you would never believe it if someone told it to you, that the greatest conqueror has as his tutor the greatest intellectual in the Western tradition, but it does appear actually to be true.
Quickly, back to the phones. Here's another caller. Robert has joined us. Good evening.
Yes, Professor, how does modern Greece view this?
A good question. Modern Greece is, of course, very fond of its ancient history, but modern Greece is interested to a greater degree. This is a very sad war, right? It's basically, it's in some sense a civil war between Greek nation, different Greek cities, which ruins everything, brings the golden age of Athens to an end, and so forth. Modern Greece is in some sense much more interested in its mythology, in particularly the Persian War, which is the great war, the previous war in which they drive the Persians away. And that is much better for a great national mythology than an internal war with such disastrous consequences.
We thank you, sir. The fellow has his phone, his radio on, which is slowing it just a bit. You know, I'm often reminded of the impossible, or I sometimes think, as an amateur consumer of history to some degree, of the impossible task which was set by one of the great founders of the modern historical style, namely Leopold von Ranke, who says that the task of the historian is to tell everything the way it really happened. Alles erzählen, wie es eigentlich gewesen war. And that was Thucydides' intention. Did he pull it off?
Most of the time he did. You to start with have to understand that the ancients gave historians a certain amount more latitude than we do in two ways. To start with, you're allowed to write speeches for your characters, which everybody knows are not actually, were not actually given. It's just assumed by everybody that those were created by the author.
And that's probably true even for the Periclean oration.
Yes, and are usually in his own style. So that, for example, the styles of Thucydidean orations do not vary very much from speaker to speaker. That's just accepted that you're allowed to do that. And it's also accepted that you're allowed to organize things for purposes of drama. You're allowed to build tension. You're allowed to hold details back until the maximum dramatic moment. This history was a form of entertainment, even Thucydides' history, although, of course, he claims that this was not a competition piece, but a possession for all time. Nevertheless, it is a form of entertainment. That being said, whenever we can test him against an exterior evidence, and there are occasions where we can do that with inscriptions and things like that, he comes out incredibly well. He seems to genuinely have been a model of careful analysis and careful gathering of information.
He tells you that his methodology is not to rely just on one account or another, but to get verification. He seems to want at least two other verifications before he credits whatever story was told him.
That's right. I mean, the great tragedy for us about Thucydides is that he does all the processing for us. He gets all that evidence, and he gathers it up. He decides what's right, and he writes it down.
He doesn't give footnotes on all of his methods.
No, exactly. And this, of course, distinguishes him from Herodotus, who doesn't give footnotes, but who always or very frequently tells you, when he has three versions of a story, he says, okay, the Persians say this, the Greeks say this, the Phoenicians say that. You, reader, get to choose. Or sometimes you say, I think this is the correct version. We find that, you know, in a generation where history is a sort of timid and rather cowardly enterprise, we find that much more appealing than Thucydides' rather arrogant, I get to decide, and then I just tell you my version. But that's how Thucydides did it.
John E. Lendon, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And thank you very much for the book. It is possibly a possession for all time, or at least it's going to get very, very closely read for many years to come, I am sure. And I much appreciate your joining us tonight.
Well, you've done me great honor. Thank you very much.
And good night for now. We will close out in just about half a minute with a quick reminder that you can hear, if you want to get this program to listen to it again, you can probably find it on our website by late tomorrow. And you can find on that website the work by the conversation with Donald Kagan on the very same subject, conversation about 8 years ago. The location is simply our webpage for this program. You go to wgnradio.com/extension720. And you find lots of other programs, some from just a week or two ago, and some from 8 or 10 years ago, and on all sorts of subjects, not only heavy wars. Until tomorrow at 11, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.